Hello, everybody. Hello, Gladys. Got a question?
Yes, I do, Jack. I'm just wondering, since I see the camera here, if during all of these sessions, since I don't have a VCR, if someone could take and tape all the newscasts and wherever we're on the news, and that we can buy them after.
Good suggestion, Gladys. Actually, we have some things taped, and we will... I'll give you an answer to that tomorrow, okay, as to what we're doing, okay? Because some of it has been recorded, some we've got it taped, and tomorrow when I do announcements, I'll let you know, okay? The other thing I want to tell you is that we have, as you know, we've extended the hours of in the hotel. Checkout time is now 1, but they're also telling you, by the way, that if you do check out at 1 and you're still doing other things, you can leave your luggage in the lounge of the hotel for the whole afternoon or whatever. So they'll keep your luggage there and look after it and make sure it's secure, so your luggage is there. Anyway, for the rest of the afternoon, we have a great treat. We have Campbell Sharma and Ken Carty are going to host you for the next hour or for as long as you like, up to 5 o'clock. And there you are, Drs. Carty, Drs. Campbell.
Ken, as ever, will be walking up and down and making statements like, movements like this. But I think the purpose is to deal with any questions, generic or in particular questions, or any general questions you have relating to the matters we've dealt with today. We dealt with quite a lot of things, and just if you have questions on parties, then Ken will tend to answer them, or Parliament I will, or we'll both jump in if we think there's more to say. So I'm pretty... we're in your hands. If you've got questions, please feel free. Yes.
My question has to do with our mandate. I was wondering if we get to determine the threshold, like the percentage threshold for who gets to be in the government.
Is that, yes. If it's the percentage threshold for who gets represented in the Assembly, it seems to me that's a question... If it's a question to do with turning votes into seats, then that's clearly something the Assembly has to think about. So, for example, if the Assembly was interested in a form of proportional representation, then we have to think about thresholds because that's one of the things that has to be specified. Ken.
Yeah, and there's lots of different kinds of thresholds you could establish. Some countries say that you have to win a certain minimum percentage of the vote. If you don't win 3 or 4% of the vote, you're just not in the game. Other countries say, well, if you win some local districts, you have to win some local districts to be in the game. You could have thresholds and say, well, a party might have to win seats in every region of the province before it would be eligible, or certain percentages. So there's as many kind of thresholds as there is imagination to create them that appear suitable to a particular place. Most proportional systems of one kind or another have some kind of threshold. But the range and different and numbers of thresholds vary. The system we have now has no threshold. It's just there's no minimum you have to have. You just have more than the next person. And that might be a lot or it might be a little bit. I mean, that's one of the things that's so indeterminate about our system. It's not at all clear what the kind of minimum is required.
Yes.
Just for my own clarification, do we in BC presently have a two-party competition or a multi-party competition system? I know the last election was just two parties.
I think by and large through most of our history, and Campbell will show you some nice pictures tomorrow. He thinks they're nice pictures, and they kind of are, about the patterns of competition. And basically for most of the time, British Columbia's had two big dominant parties. Occasionally other parties have tried to get in, and not all that successfully. So it's been a system in which two parties have tended to dominate. Which parties they were have changed over time. And there were periods in which there was were three parties, and when there was kind of even three-party competition, two of them, in fact, joined together to effectively form a kind of whole block. We'll talk about some of that history tomorrow, but I think it's probably fair to say that largely we've been divided into two big camps through most of our history.
Yes.
I have a couple of points to make. We keep coming back to the mandate, and it seems almost inevitable when you get into the conversations. And I don't think any of us have ever presented anything to the legislature before, so we're a little bit blind to that. And I've been trying to word a question here to Jack, but I'll just kind of jump the gun. It's just, how will the final report look? And is there a way of showing us something similar that's presented to the legislature so we have an idea of... I think that would solve a lot of the questions that keep coming back to us on that. On that, I have a couple of examples. If we're outside our mandate, can we attach recommendations that, you know, are not binding, that give the flavor of what the Citizens' Assembly is about, i.e., we've talked a lot about voter turnout, and, you know, and there's a couple of options there. You can talk about, legislated mandatory voting, or you could talk about a tax rebate issue. Is there something that if we gained a consensus within this assembly, could we attach that to that? You know, there's lots of questions there, but if we could see a solid example.
Well, I would
of sooner that.
Ken or Campbell answer the question, but I'm happy to do so. They might help me out. It's not actually, the answer is not totally clear. Our mandate is actually fairly clear. Our mandate is how do votes determine who sits in the House. And they also made it very clear that this excludes a whole bunch of other kinds of things, some of the many things that you talked about. Now, that mandate is, in and of itself, while it's fairly focused, it's fairly substantial. That's a very important decision. And my hunch is that we're going to try and keep to that mandate, because if we get into a whole bunch of other kinds of things, we will never actually give full consideration to what we really do have to make a recommendation on. Should we change the system by which votes determine who sits in the House? That's a very important decision, so we really have to give sufficient time to it. As we've been learning, it's fairly complex, and the fundamentals are there, and they're starting to emerge, but we should focus on that mandate. You asked a couple of other questions, and indeed you anticipated some things that we were going to raise with the Assembly in terms of business matters. You know, I hate to take away too much time for business, because what we have to do is to learn from these gentlemen and from ourselves about what we have to do. But the final report we have discussed generally, and I was going to bring to the Assembly what the final report might look like. Very, quite simple. Actually, the terms of reference, the Order and Council basically tell you what to do. They tell you mostly what to do in the report. One is our recommendation. What is our recommendation? Is there change or not? And if we do recommend a change, or whether we do or not, we have to give reasons why we have come to that conclusion. Whatever our decision is, we have to make it clear what our decision is, and then we have to say, this is why we have come to this decision. If indeed we recommend a change and recommend a new system of voting, what we also have to prepare, and again, I want Ken and Campbell to come in this if I don't get it exactly right, because I think they've read the terms maybe even more than I have, is that we have to recommend what that system is. And then we have to prepare for the referendum an objective description of what we now have, an objective description of what we're proposing, and the reason why we're proposing what we are. And then we also, from that, frame a very simple yes or no question for the referendum. In terms of our report, therefore, our report eventually will be our decision, the reasons why we came to that decision. A second part of that report will be the process, all the way from the original selection meetings to the learning phase, the public hearings, the deliberation phase. So we will describe that process in detail. We will append all the names and biographies of the members of the assembly. That essentially is the report. I have thought about perhaps the report might have something called other considerations. But I don't want to talk about that a lot right at this point, because I think we really have to. We've got a big job with the mandate that we've got. But other kinds of things might come up that we might want to comment on later. I'm mentioning that now because it has occurred to us. But we don't want to give that terribly much prominence, because if we get into other kinds of things, we will not fulfill our mandate. Ken Campbell, would you like to expand on that?
No, I would never contradict you, Jack.
I just have one small point to make after that one. It would be nice after the discussion forums if we had some sort of summary of what all the groups discussed, because we don't ever hear what the other groups have discussed. Something very brief, or like after the very first discussion group, we all kind of gave a summary of what each group covered. Now, I don't think we can go that detailed, but something brief or even something posted in point form?
Certainly the facilitators, we have a meeting after on Sunday afternoon to kind of talk about how it went and what we can do differently and so on. And they're keeping kind of track of the general themes just because they're trying to pay attention to the groups they're working with. And I'm sure we could ask them to kind of jot down the two or three important points that came out of them each and prepare a very simple summary report if people would find that helpful.
Yes.
Yes. Is there any constitutional law that allows for the elimination of an opposition party? What I'm getting at is that following the election and following the dissolution of Parliament, the lieutenant governor would call upon the leader of the party winning the most seats to form a government. It so happens that the leader at that particular time knew he could form a government, but he, under the common rules of Westminster and the rules of parliamentary procedure, historically, there must be Whigs and Tories. There must be a winning party and an opposition, which makes the winners prove their point. He knew that he couldn't do this. The lieutenant governor knew he couldn't do this. And yet we have a strong majority party, which in fact could be considered a dictatorship. So I'm asking, is this legal? Thank you.
Well, before I turn it over to Ken, I think I will say yes.
Second question, is it right?
I'm sorry, the second one was? That's as they say, outside the mandate.
I guess I'm not quite sure what your first question is. Can you sharpen it for me? What exactly was...
The question was, is there any international constitutional law, that allows for the elimination of the sitting of a parliament under the democratic process without an opposition?
Well,
Ken, New Brunswick.
You could have a legislature in which one party won all the seats. That's happened twice in Canadian history, once in Prince Edward Island and very recently in New Brunswick, in which one party simply won all the seats. It didn't win all the votes, of course, but the electoral system gave it all the seats, and they were just the members of the legislature. And so we had 4 years in New Brunswick when Frank McKenna, there was literally not a single opposition member. It made it pretty easy for the government. We're close to that kind of situation in this province today where we have 77-2. That's the way it turned out under our kind of system. And that really means that the parliamentary system doesn't work very well in terms of the kind of things Campbell said that this morning that parliaments have to do. I guess that's how I would answer it. I think Ken had a question.
Yes.
He had his hand up here.
Hi there. I was just wondering if you could briefly outline the process of 160 people writing and editing the final recommendation document. Sounds somewhat onerous.
Well, Ken may have a version of this in Jack too. What normally happens is you have slaves to do the writing. And the idea is that the Assembly gives a clear but broad description of where it wants to go. And then that is turned into seamless, deathless prose, which the Assembly then accepts or reviews. I agree, if you had 160 people trying to edit it, there would be problems. But basically, it's the Assembly's report. So whoever writes it, whatever team writes it, it has to be acceptable to the Assembly. Okay.
Fred had a question?
Yeah, Fred.
Well, one thing I'd like to say that you would have to mention my name. I cannot respond to eye contact or pointing. You have to mention my name, otherwise I don't know whether you want me to speak or not. I'd like to go back to the question of thresholds. Is it not correct that the higher the percentage of thresholds, the less the system would encourage small political parties? And my second question, or my second request, would be, would it be possible for us to use our last British Columbia election, the numbers, the percentages of votes, and put it into a PR system and show us that this, if this is possible, could that be looked at and discussed by the smaller groups?
Ken will have comments to say on both of these, but just for the first one, from my point of view, the thresholds are, as Ken indicated, quite varied. For example, one of the things which Ken had on his excellent description of multi-member or systems which tend to lead to multi-member parties is that, or the proportional representation tends to lead to more than two parties. If a party is geographically concentrated in one area, then it may be easier for a small party to get representation under a plurality system than it is under a proportional one. So I'm just reiterating the point that thresholds vary enormously. You can have different thresholds under different electoral systems. It depends on the context and what you want to achieve. Ken.
Just to talk about your second question, Fred, could we take the results of the last provincial election and stick them into different electoral systems and see how it would have come out? Well, of course we can, and we will if people would like that. But I think one of the things we think is that if we'd had a different system, we would have probably had different political parties running. If we'd had different political parties running and different kinds of parties running, people might have voted differently. So while we can say that under a PR system, after the last election, the Liberals would have got so many seats, the Marijuana Party would have got so many seats, the New Democrats would have got so many seats, the Greens would have got so many seats, and so on. Those parties might not have run in the same way. Other parties might have run. The Millionaires Party might have swept out of Gold River won a whole series of votes, because people would have seen that voting for them wouldn't have been a kind of hopeless cause. And so while it's possible to take results from other elections and plunk them into a different system, that can be kind of deceptive. We can kind of fool ourselves into thinking, oh, that's how it would be. It wouldn't be probably like that, because what would happen is that under a different system, different people would have different incentives to get in the game or get out of the game or behave differently. Take our example. If we had a different system, the Alliance and the Conservatives wouldn't be combining. Now, if they combine or if they don't combine, people are going to vote differently. People who liked them when they were separated might not like them together, and vice versa. So this is what makes kind of doing what Fred suggests difficult. We can do it, but in doing it, we don't want to fool ourselves into thinking that that's the kind of thing that would happen.
I think it's a useful notional exercise, as long as people realize that it's just notional. It's not an attempt to predict what would happen or what would have happened if the system had been in place. Yes.
All I was saying actually is so that people would have a little better understanding the results of that kind of vote. That's all.
No, I think that's very helpful. I think it will be helpful to know. If you go to some form of proportional system or you want to investigate that, then you're going to have larger districts, and then that's, in BC's case, that presents problems, or presents an interesting challenge is the way to say. Yes. There was someone in the back there who asked a question. Yes. Yes, Alan.
If parties are here to vacuum the votes, as we say, they're also here to vacuum the money. What happens to the money in a PR system? Where does it flow?
I think I shall handball that one to Ken.
Well, most democracies in the last 20 or 30 years have begun to regulate political money, at least with respect to elections, in all kinds of ways. We do it now in this country quite differently from province to province and international elections. And so the whole kind of regulation of election money, which obviously has profound effects on what parties do and can do, is an important question. It's not within our mandate. We have a particular electoral finance regulation system in place in British Columbia now. One, I suspect, that's going to have to be quite changed. The implementation of fixed vote elections kind of makes the existing system we have kind of silly and irrelevant, because what it did was it regulated the amount you could spend from the beginning of the election till the end of the election. And that was fine when you didn't know when the beginning was, but now when everybody knows, they can spend right up to the day before, and so the whole control of election finance is really kind of disintegrated in British Columbia. But that's really beyond our mandate. It was, and any given electoral system could have any other given political finance system attached to it. But clearly, the political finance system, I think Alan's right, has a profound effect on the kind of parties and the kind of campaigning they do and when they do it and how they do it. And that's another whole wide open series. And it has been ruled out of our mandate, I think probably deliberately, because it would take us into another whole kind of field. And maybe if we do a good job, there'll be a citizens' assembly on political money.
Yes. Someone? Yes.
I think it would help if people would wave their name tags, or name card, tent cards, white things with names on them, because it is hard actually to see across this room sometimes. Okay, Lana.
Lana, yes.
I was just wondering, since New Zealand has changed their electoral reform, what was the outcome negative? Like, was there many, many parties that turned up on the ballot, or did it eventually just end up being five parties? Or?
Well, there are now seven parties in the legislature. When we come to talk about that system, we can. Some people, of course, thought that was a positive. They now had a range of choices that was different. The first election was confused because really the parties didn't understand it more than the voters. The voters figured out how to cast their votes. The parties didn't really kind of know how to campaign, and some of them said, well, we'll do this and then we'll do that. And then when they got into the legislature, they suddenly realized, oh, this wasn't a kind of parliament like the one we're used to, because now it's different. And so different kind of coalitions were formed. And it's taken two or three elections for them, really more the politicians than the voters, to figure out how that system's going to work. And it's begun to settle down. So I think what happens is that when you change a system, there's a long learning process. And since you kind of learn a new lesson at every election, that might take a decade, because it might take two or three years. And then you have an election, we did that wrong last time, now we'll try this, and it doesn't quite work. And so they move on. And so there's a kind of cyclical effect. And New Zealanders have now developed a kind of system that seems to be working relatively well for them. We'll talk a little bit more about it, I suppose, later.
You may get turbulence. What happens when you make a major change to the electoral system is you get oscillations or change. I was thinking of the Australian Capital Territory, which was an area which had a self-government since 1989. It's an area a bit like Ottawa. Imagine it as a little province. And it adopted a proportional system and then another one for various reasons. But it started off with lots of parties and gradually has gradually moved in the other direction to only about 2.5 to 3. So it's really what you can be sure of is if you change the electoral rules, there will be turbulence in the party system. But it doesn't necessarily move in the direction you might expect. It's just the rules change and people move and change. And as Ken says, the parties learn new tricks and the voters learn new tricks. So it's hard to predict exactly. Margaret.
Thank you. I have two questions. This afternoon there was a presentation that included some comments on who chooses the candidate. And we're all watching the American elections now and seeing that they have primaries to choose candidates for parties. But I've never heard anything about that in a system, a sort of parliamentary-based system. Would it in fact be legal to have the people choose, the voters choose candidates in a parliamentary system rather than to have them chosen by the party or as they are now? And the second part of my question is, this morning we were supposed to have some discussion about how important it is to have a local member or how important it isn't. And we didn't get to that, and I wonder if we could spend some time on that.
I'll just a brief try at both of those. The first one is parties is Ken's particular baby, so he should answer that. But the point of view is, from my point of view, is there's nothing to stop the legislature making rules about how parties operate. In fact, the more what's been happening in Western liberal democracies over the last 10 years or so, 10 or 20 years, is that the state has been intervening more in the way parties operate. So legal challenges, court challenges about the way they carry out their business. Now, Ken will have more on that. The second one, I left out the local member, A, because we ran out of time, and B, because to a certain extent it's the other side of what you expect your assembly to represent. They're kind of the same question, and I was sure that that issue would certainly come up again. It's not as though it's going to go away. But if people want to raise issues about questions about that later, that's fine by me. Ken?
I think there's electoral systems could easily provide for primaries because electoral systems are going to have to specify whose names are on ballots and kind of where they come from. And they do say who the candidates are, whether they're prepared by parties or where they come from and what the conditions of getting your name on a ballot are is an integral part of any electoral system. And there's nothing to say you couldn't have primary systems of various kinds. We're almost there now. Apparently anybody can vote in a number of parties for their candidates if you can get someone to pay the $10 fee for you and you can kind of show up at a meeting. I mean, we really are in leadership and nomination contests in this country very close to primaries. What we have are kind of primaries that are run by kind of private entrepreneurs, like who are making up the rules in back rooms as they go along. Inevitably, I think there's kind of growing demand for, well, wait a minute, that's an integral part of this whole process. It ought to be regulated, too. Who the candidates are, who the names on the ballots are an integral part of any electoral system. And so there's nothing to, I don't think, forestall primaries.
Just a rider on that, one of the paradoxes is that parties originally were, and Ken used the analogy of the utility, were classically voluntary, private, voluntary organizations. And they're increasingly acquiring the characteristic of semi-governmental authorities. Is that fair, Ken?
Sure.
Okay. Sorry, yes.
One thing I noticed within the discussion groups is that people are very divided. Everybody votes within their constituencies for their MPs or MLAs. And I'm wondering, is that where the problem actually lies within our government, is the fact that everybody is so divided that we're thinking about our areas as opposed to our province? And is there some kind of an electoral system that could bring across the important issues to our province as a whole and, as a stepladder of what is most important? And if the system came across that way, would it be so much more that the political parties wouldn't be actually competing on actual mandate, but what's important to BC as a whole? Is there some kind of electoral system that could take away that competition based on, so many people are voting on the idea that the hospitals are an issue, or do you know what I mean?
Well,
so there's not so much.
You could have a system in which there were no constituencies, and the people just voted on a province-wide basis. You could do that on a majority or plurality or proportional system in different kinds of ways. The base on which people vote, that's voters vote on the issues that they think are important and are relevant to them. And they may be local issues or personality or leadership or policies or programs or the province or whatever.
Yeah, but each of those issues are important to that constituency, and they are not being represented because the majority of the government is that their MLAs are not being represented in the assembly. So as a whole, how could the people of British Columbia come together and decide what is most important as a whole to British Columbians and who as a political party would be most capable of representing them in the assembly in a majority seating?
Julie, do you want to respond?
In our group, we talked a fair amount about, and we divided, we didn't think that the electoral system really had anything to do with deciding what was important for the province today, tomorrow, 50 years, 100 years down the road, because those parties aren't going to be in power. And we broached the subject about core values and how does a government establish that there are core values in the province that no government can touch, that you can't privatize the rail or sell off BC Ferries or cancel contracts and change the education system, change the healthcare system, just change everything unilaterally. And I don't know how other countries do that, but I'm beginning to feel that we, when you talk about globally, and I'm not sure that an electoral system can help that, that somehow or other embedded in our whole system of government, I feel, and a number of my fellow members felt, that there are some things that should simply be protected by whoever is in Parliament, and we don't have that. And I don't know that has anything to do with the particular electoral system or if an electoral system can affect that. Maybe you can answer that.
In the morning, we remember one of the early slides was the different things that you expect an assembly to do, and many of them are conflicting. They are inconsistent. So you can't expect... Some assembly members will be driven by local concerns, some national. It will vary on the nature of the issue and the time of day. So it's government making collective decisions is very tricky. As Ken says, it's a constant trade-off of a whole range of concerns. On the bit of core values, the normal response would be to say the place for core values is the Constitution. And constitutions usually are entrenched. That is, they're very difficult to change. So that means usually constitutions stress process. They say if you want to do it, you must do it in this particular way. Because one of the problems with entrenching particular things is that fashions change. And then all of a sudden you find you want to make a change and you can't, or you have to go through some constitutional amendments because someone 20 or 30 years ago thought it was a great idea. Let me give you an example to ponder. No answers required. Would it be a good thing if BC had its electoral system entrenched? I question yes, because it's so vital to the well-being of the province, or no, because it's a matter of taste and preference, and times will change, and therefore it should be open to the government of the day to change the system as it sees fit. So there's always this dilemma between entrenching things and making the system responsive. Douglas and then John.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I made a little research on my own, maybe it's not important but interesting. From our members, 161, 43 of us, they are new Canadians, which it means emigrated to this country in the last 45, 50 years, plus 23 are second-generation Canadians, which it means the children of new immigrants. These numbers represent practically 33% of our little community here. This number is interesting for British Columbian. When this referendum is coming up, the participation of ethnic or new Canadians and young people are minimal. About 800,000 people did not register to vote at the last election. From this 800,000, roughly 600,000 ethnic Canadians or young Canadians. If we cannot reach this group of people, we are never going to reach 75-80% yes vote from the population. This is all what I wanted to say. It's not interesting, but they are the facts of life. In British Columbia, there are minimum 2.5 million immigrants or immigrant children. And we have to reach this huge treasure of voters. This is what I wanted to say. And I promise you, I don't open my mouth for a long time. There are so many interesting people around here, and we are discussing any kind of problems. But this country is not like any other country. I was reading the chart of the beautiful blue book, the 7th and the 9th and the paragraph and so on and so. And this Dr. Zenz gave me a beautiful booklet. referendum in Switzerland. Since I cannot sleep at night, I'm ever studying last night. We are far away from Switzerland. But in this little country in Europe, every major problem of the country is solved by referendum. From the army of 21st century, vocational education for the young children, rent, health care, atom reactors, so on. And every major problem is solved by binding referendum. Don't talk anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Ken, you want? Douglas.
I just want to clarify, Jack was mentioning our mandate. Page 3 in David Farrell's book, bottom right-hand corner, last paragraph, he lists that the things that the electoral reform include are ballot structure style, the votes into seats, basically who gets in, how citizens vote, and the methods of counting. That really does outline our mandate, or does our mandate go beyond that? Because I read those four statements, and from what I could tell, that's what you were basically trying to inform us, that is what we're limited to do. We're focusing on those four main topics. Is our mandate exactly that, or is it just beyond that, or way beyond that?
I think it's basically that, and that's, you know, a bookload of stuff.
It is.
To follow up on Jack, I mean, there are big questions and big considerations. In the end, it comes down to a series of fundamental decisions, which we need to tie back to our values and concerns about British Columbia. But really, we're being asked, is there a different kind of electoral system that we want to recommend for British Columbia? And these are the key features of it that if we make a report saying we want to change, we would have to say something about those, because there are the various aspects of a system that need to be specified for us to have a full account of a system. We have to say something about the ballot, about the counting rules, about...
So we cannot look at, for instance, because I've heard it here, things like percentages to make a majority.
Percentages of what, Doug?
Percentages that make a majority within a legislature when a bill is being passed. The ages of the electorate. For instance, it's not within our mandate to even consider the age of voting to be changed. That doesn't really fit into any of those four statements.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, we can't say, let's take the vote away from all political science professors and shut them up. our mandate is not with the franchise. It's not with those questions. It's really with the basic
those four
mechanisms
statements.
Of voting, the processes
okay.
of elections.
Through to Jack, the other question I have, it's very brief. It's a numerical answer. How many MPs do we have in attendance this weekend? MLAs, I should say. We had a couple on our initial weekend. We're just wondering.
I don't believe there are any.
Okay, thank you.
But I have to say the sitting MLAs have, for the most part, I think for good reasons, have not taken part in this process. I mean, there have been the legislature as a whole has tried to depoliticize the citizen assembly, and I think for the large part. That is the main reason why they have not been to the selection meetings or here. I think they're very interested in what we're doing.
Yes. Abi.
Thank you. I think it's a question about the process we are in. As you know, we are going through this learning process, which is very important, we understand. And also... political education, as I said on the first day, I believe is an essential prerequisite of democracy. But it is good if all the British Columbians can have this learning process we are going through, which we know it's not practical and it is not something we can achieve. My question is, once this assembly comes up with some decisions, maybe to change the present electoral system. And if you do, as we understand, it's going to a referendum. But what is the process in place for the public as such, all the British Columbians, to understand the rationale behind the decision we are going to make, for them to prepare themselves for the referendum. Because they don't know what we are discussing here on a day-to-day basis. So we are here because this is a process for the people to take decisions as to how the electoral system of this province should be changed, if a change is necessary. So I'd like to know whether there is a process in place, and if not, what can we do about it?
Well, subject to Ken and Jack, once it seems to me, once the Assembly is completed its work, then the task falls to other groups in the community. And from my point of view, if there is a change recommended, unlike most other referendum campaigns I've heard of, there will be 160 people in the community who know about the issue that's going to be put to the people. So there's this 160 doesn't sound very many, but they'll be spread around the province, and there'll be plenty of opportunity for people to ask them questions instead of having to look at groups that have sprung up spontaneously to try and support whatever proposal is made. You collectively form a major resource for public education.
Rick, Ken, and Julie.
Okay, Ken. Yes. Ken, you've got
No. Do you have a list? Are you keeping a list
yes.
of names in order?
Rick, Ken, and Julie.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the logistics would be of actually publishing or distributing our recommendation document, which clearly outlines the present system, the reason we suggest making changes, and what the resulting system would be. That seems to me like it would be a very informative document for the population to be able to make their decision on that referendum question.
Jack.
I think it's an excellent idea in the first place.
You're right. And we will ensure that that document is as widely distributed as possible. Clearly, it will be on our website. Clearly, it will be in all libraries. We hope to have sufficient funds left then to publish a report and distribute that widely. Anybody who requests that report will get it. My hunch is, too, and I don't know, and it was an answer to someone else's question, nobody has ever actually had a referendum in Canada where they've actually involved the public as much as they've done in this one. I think that in that respect, Campbell's absolutely right. This has received far more attention than it would have received had it gone about it in any other way. We have 160 people throughout all of British Columbia who will know by then quite a bit about this question. That has never happened before with any referendum in Canada, and we do have a good representative sample. We will issue a report, and we hope that we will get it in as many hands, at least in the hands of anybody who's interested. We will make sure they'll get a copy of that report.
So who's next on the list?
Ken is next.
Ken. Rick.
That's okay. I just want to touch on what Douglas was saying. I was kind of hoping he'd get to it. I thought what he was going to say is, will we have a bearing on thresholds, percentages, things like that? Because that can change a lot of what we're... I know he mentioned the age to vote, but I wanted to get to the thresholds, because if something was to go to PR, that's part of it. So.
Well, we talk about PR, we'll have to talk about thresholds.
So we would have a direct impact on the thresholds, or is that...
If we make a recommendation for PR, I would assume it would involve some statement about a threshold. Either there isn't one or there is. Well, there has to be some kind of...
But we don't actually decide the thresholds. We
I think any recommendation about an electoral system is going to, as Jack said, has to be fairly detailed, because the logic is that the voters need to know what they're going to be voting on. And if you're going to recommend a PR system for them, you're going to have to tell them what kind of PR system, what thresholds exist, and how you know.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
Julie.
I understood, this is with regard to what RB asked, I understood that if we do recommend that there be a change and it goes to referendum, that the referendum will contain a basic outline of the conclusion that we came to, not the full report and so on and so forth, but basically Ken covered everything else that I had to say. But was I correct in understanding that the referendum, if we do recommend a change, that the referendum would give the voter somewhat of a synopsis?
I don't know. Ken?
I don't know either. I think that quite what it will say. I imagine a referendum question would have to say something like, are you in favor of the system recommended by the Citizens' Assembly? Now, how much would go before that? Would it be a long description of that or a 20-page description or a one-paragraph description? I don't know. Because fortunately, I don't have to run the referendum. But it seems to me that the logic of the situation the Assembly is in, if it makes a recommendation, and if it's going to go to the people, the question will be, do you support the recommendation? That's the bottom line question, and hopefully it will be expressed as cleanly and as clearly as that. And obviously, you've got to tell people what the recommendation is in a fair amount of detail so they can answer that question intelligently.
I was just hoping that a part of our recommendation, if we do make one for change, would include what it should look like as it goes to the people. And maybe that's one of the details.
That's a good point, Julie.
Jerry.
We've talked today about that the multi-party system can be less stable and reaching decisions can be more difficult. I wonder if you can discuss what factors can limit these more negative elements of the multi-party system.
Well, it's a matter of taste, isn't it, Ken?
Well... You really don't want to answer these questions, do you? If you're really saying, are there ways to limit multi-party bargaining in Parliament, there are various kinds of parliamentary rules. For instance, the Germans have a system that reflects their experience between the wars when they had lots of governments falling, and they don't have votes of confidence. They have votes of what they call positive confidence. So you can't vote to defeat the government in Germany because people might want to do it any given week. You can only vote to elect a new one. So people can't get together and say, well, we don't like these guys, let's vote them out, and then we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll reshuffle the deck and we might do better. The only way you can do it is actually vote for a government. And that's reduced considerably in parliaments that adopt that kind of parliamentary rule, the propensity for people to kind of defeat governments because they got the chance to do so. They can't do it. Thresholds do the same kind of thing by limiting the kind or the number of players in a system. So there could be electoral system rules, but there are also going to be lots of parliamentary rules that govern those kinds of relationships. Parliamentary rules are not our business from our point of view. If you have a multi-party parliament, one of the things that will happen is that parliament will have to sit down and draw a whole new set of rules about how they're going to operate. Most of the kind of normal rules of operating our parliament are going to have to be altered because they've been designed over the years for essentially a two-party or a two-and-a-half-party kind of parliament. The assumption is a big government, big opposition, majority government. If you're in a situation where that no longer exists on a regular basis, parliament will begin to change the rules to kind of accommodate the new situation. And one of the things that we hope to talk to Elizabeth McClay about is kind of that learning process for parliaments, because electoral systems by changing parliaments, then they have to begin to change. And so that's why we've talked a lot about the consequences of these changes, because it's not a matter of just votes in the seats. The question is then what happens with those kinds of seats, because you want to understand what we're doing. So that's a long answer. I'm sorry.
Another aspect is, I wasn't only being half facetious by saying it was a matter of taste. One person's instability is another person's responsiveness. And I gather that in some of the breakout sessions, there was a difference of view about whether multi-party system, if it produces coalition and minority governments, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. That's a matter of opinion. So to ask how can you fix it is presuming that it needs fixing. Okay, we've got a list of four people here. Janice?
Tanis,
I'm sorry.
By the time your name gets called, your question seems a little irrelevant. I just wanted to mention I think it was a fellow over there, Fred, maybe, who was asking about what kind of government we would have if we had a PR system in the last election. And just for a quick snapshot of that, there is a document on the table out there called Free Your Vote that has that scenario in that document. It's out on the table. I think it's produced by the Green Party. And then just in terms of public education as well. Yes, we will have a responsibility when we're all done to go out into our areas and talk about what we've learned, but I think that we can do that throughout this process as well. And one of the things that I've proposed to my local newspaper is would they be interested in, you know, a little article from me once a month or something, just on my reflections of what I've been learning, as opposed to, you know, kind of like an opinion piece of, you know, what Tanis thinks is great today. So I just wanted to bring that to people's attention too, that, you know, that this is something that we can do alongside this is to help to educate the people in our areas. So I think that's it. Thanks.
Holly.
Yeah, I just have a little bit of concern with the idea that we do not have money or a contingency plan put aside to promote whatever we come out with. Like, yes, 160 people can promote this well, but I don't know about that myself. The other thing I'll say, and we talk about the whole system of picking an electoral system, and some of you have heard this already, but it comes down to what Ken said right at the very beginning, is we've got to know who we are. And then we have to look at each option of each electoral system and look at the trade-offs, because everything's a trade-off, and see how it relates to who we are and whether more parties are better or less, or, you know, and all those things. But I think you go back to the very original statement of who we are and trying to find the best system of who fits us.
Thanks. Diana?
In terms of letting the rest of the province know what this process is all about, it's my understanding Knowledge Network is making a documentary, and I think we need to talk to Knowledge Network, find out just exactly what it is they're going to be doing, and when we know what they've got and when it's going to be broadcast, encouraging people to take a look at that.
That's quite a good point. One of the things that they are going to do as a kind of spin-off is that at the end of our first learning phase, they're going to produce a kind of 10-minute short, in some sense, version of our interim report. Kind of saying, this is what the Assembly's done in this first phase. This is kind of what they're saying that the people ought to be thinking about. And hopefully, there'll be lots of copies of those videos, and that maybe we could show it at the beginning of every public hearing. And if Assembly members were at those public hearings, they could say, yes, this is what we did, and this kind of reflects. And if people said, well, I don't kind of get why you were doing that, you can participate in that process. So the public hearing process is a process in which the message of the Assembly can go out, but also the message of the people then can come back, and there can be a kind of dialogue. And I think that the Knowledge Network, it'll be about a 10-minute video, I think, that's going to be done, will be a helpful tool. And, of course, once it's made, it's cheap to make lots of copies, either on CD form or tape form, and they can be distributed fairly widely, too.
Okay, I've got three names, and I think I probably have to hand to Jack to close. I've got Colin next. Yes, Colin.
My question kind of centers around the referendum issue. What happens, say, hypothetically, the referendum passes and it goes in favor of whatever our mission statement is or what we recommend? The referendum is non-binding, and does it go back to the government and they kind of do whatever they want with it, or what happens after the referendum?
Well, this question I'm going to handle too, but the main thing is that the job of the Assembly, as far as I'm concerned, ends on the 31st of December or slightly before that, 2004. Although, and if it discharges its job fully and expertly and produces a recommendation, let's suppose it recommends change, with a beautifully written report with strong recommendations that are very persuasive, then it's discharged its mandate. And what happens after that is of great concern, or maybe of great concern to the members of the Assembly, but it's not the Assembly's responsibility.
But I'm just saying, can it be changed after that? I mean, will they rip it apart and say, this is not what we want?
Well, anything is possible.
It just seems kind of pointless then, you know.
You underestimate the ability of the Assembly to be persuasive, not only by the strength of its reasoning, but also politically. If
if the Assembly puts a strong case and it gets backed by the, and it persuades the community of British Columbia that the change, if there is a change recommended, is a good thing, that will be a difficult thing for any government to ignore. So I think it pays not to be too cynical. Right. I've got Anne and then Chuck. Anne.
Yes, thank you. You talked about the public hearings. That's what I want to talk about as well. As far as I understand, the community process is a tool that's designed to get the message out to the communities and allow people to come in and discuss it and sort of almost mimic what we're doing here, to discuss it, to hear it. Some of us will be attending those meetings. That'll show that we are learning these processes. And we've also had great news coverage, and it's only the beginning. And a number of us have been interviewed, and I see pictures of people in different places, and all of that really helps to get people talking. I'm not sure about you, but my friends are interested, and they're saying, hey, I saw you on TV. People are starting to talk about it. There's a buzz out there, and then I think that we can encourage to keep growing. And as long as we keep focused on the goal that we're trying to make a positive influence on the way our government works, I think that the rest of the people of the province will also adopt that. But this is something really positive and we should be talking about.
Thanks. Chuck. Where is Chuck? Yes, Chuck.
Yep, that's me. I have a question about the party system again. How much influence does a non-elected advisor have in the selection of an individual to represent a party? And under a PR system with many parties, do you think that influence will diminish?
I think it's really up to the party to decide how it runs its own affairs, and some parties allow their staff people to have lots of influence, and other parties have a tradition where that doesn't happen. That's not something that's probably particularly related to the electoral system. It speaks more to the culture and style of individual parties.
Okay, Jake.
Just one response about the circulation of the report. Don McLaughlin tells me that if it's a brilliantly, smoothly written report of manageable size, there's every likelihood the Vancouver Sun will publish it in full. And there's 500,000 copies up and down the province right there. So that gives us every incentive to be clear and crisp in our report. And as Ann said, it seems to me that we're one of the few good news stories in this province. And, you know, if we continue to do that, that has, I think Ann's right, a profound effect on the community we live in.
Well, I would just echo those statements. My hunch is that I'm quite surprised how much attention the Citizens Assembly is getting. This is the best process that I've been associated with. And one thing that has really impressed me over last weekend and this weekend, and both in the Assembly itself and the plenary session, but also in the discussion groups, is that we have done, I think, at a remarkable level, and that is we have discussed political matters without getting partisan. And I think that is going to be one of the indicators of our success, Colin. You know, in terms of how well we do our job, how well we actually work together. We will have disagreements and whatever, but how well we do our job, learn together, and how clearly we make our statement at the end, change or no change, I think will have an enormous impact. There are commitments, by the way, of this government and this premier that if there is a referendum and if it passes, they'll comply. But there have been commitments by other political parties, too, that they would do this. And so my hunch is it's up to us to do just an absolutely first-class job. And I think it will almost take care of itself. I've got a couple of little announcements. One is that for those who are unable to attend a computer training session, there will be a chance to take a tour of the Assembly websites, how to use the websites, tomorrow before breakfast and after lunch. So sign up. There's a message board downstairs, you know, in the concourse. If you sign up there, you can sign up for the pre-breakfast or after-lunch website tours. Also on that whiteboard, there's other announcements for staff, and you should look there from time to time. Dinner is at 6. For those of you who are interested, there's a cash bar at 5:30. And, of course, Doug is going to lead us as a DJ after dinner. So we'll see you at 5:30 or 6 then. Thank you very much.